Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves, presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp for your chance to win a $200 tattered cover gift certificate. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Tattered Cover on Colfax Avenue. Tonight, we're very proud to welcome Rafe Larson, author of the selected works of T.S. Spivet. I've been an advocate of this book since before it came out. I think it's just wonderful, magical, fantastic. And it's exciting to report that this week, as of last week, it's number 11 on the Indie Next bestseller list for hardcover fiction. And Rafe just told me tonight it's number 30 on the New York Times bestseller list. So... Rafe Larson studied at Brown University and taught briefly at Columbia University, where he received an MFA in fiction. He is also a filmmaker, and this is his first novel. Just a little information. This recording is being recorded for podcasting on authorsontourlive.com. So we're excited about that. And so please join me in welcoming Rafe Larson.
Hi. Thank you so much for coming out. I really appreciate it. Probably most of you have not read this book, so I know that you're taking a chance by coming here. I have been doing on this the beginning of this tour, I've been showing slides from the book and reading simultaneously. I don't know if you've gotten a chance to crack the binding, but the book is encircled by all these marginalia maps and diagrams that the main character T.S. Spivet draws. So it's hard to recreate the reading experience orally as I'm doing, because I think every experience on the page for is very different for every reader. So, but tonight we're going to do just a straight up old fashioned reading, old style. So. You'll have to use your imagination, and then... you guys want to follow along?
Yeah.
Don't follow along too closely, because you'll see that my reading is somewhat excerpted, so I skip around here and there. It's difficult, it's always difficult to give, a 14-minute reading that kind of has an arc to it and to a flow to it, because novels are meant to be these expansive creatures that you sit with for days. So, but maybe just let the pictures seep in as I read for you. Okay, you all right? So, so I'm just going to start from the beginning. I was going to start from the end, but the beginning seems like a better place. The phone call came late one August afternoon as my older sister Gracie and I sat out on the back porch, shucking the sweet corn into the big tin buckets. The buckets were still peppered with little teeth marks from this past spring when very well our ranch hound became depressed and turned to eating metal. Perhaps I should clarify. When I say that Gracie and I were shucking the sweet corn, what I actually mean is that that Gracie was shucking the corn and I was drawing a diagrammatic map in one of my little blue spiral notebooks of precisely how she was shucking the corn. All of my notebooks were color-coded. The blue notebooks that neatly lined the south wall of the room were reserved for maps of people doing things, as opposed to the green notebooks on the east wall, which contained zoological, geological, and topographical maps. Or the red notebooks on the west wall, which was where I mapped out insect anatomy in case my mother, Dr. Claire Linear Kerr Spivet, ever called upon my services. I had once tried lining maps on the north wall of my room, but in my excitement to organize, I briefly forgot that this was where the entrance to my room was located, and when Dr. Claire opened the door to announce that dinner was ready, the bookshelf fell on my head. I sat on my Lewis and Clark carpet, covered in notebooks and shelving. Am I dead? I asked, knowing that she would not tell me, even if I was. Never let your work trap you into a corner, Dr. Claire said through the door. And I think she was right. I constantly battled the curious weight of entropy in my tiny bedroom, which was stuffed to the gills with the sediment of a cartographer's life. Surveying equipment, antique telescopes, sextants, long rolls of goose twine, jars of rabbit wax, compasses, withered malodorous weather balloons, a sparrow skeleton perched on my drafting table. At the moment of my birth, the sparrow had fatally crashed into the kitchen window. A stiff-legged ornithologist from Billings reconstructed the shattered skeleton, and I was given a new middle name. Every instrument in my room hung on a hook, and on the wall behind each piece, I had drawn and labeled the outline of the apparatus like an echo of the real thing, so that I always knew when something was missing and where it must be returned to. Still, even with such a system in place, things fell and things broke. Piles formed, and my methods of orientation always seemed to unravel. I was only 12, but through the slow, inevitable burn of 1,000 sunrises and sunsets, 1,000 maps traced and retraced, I had already absorbed the valuable precept that everything crumbled into itself eventually, and to cultivate a crankiness about this was just a waste of time. My room was no exception. It was not uncommon for me to wake up in the middle of the night with my bed full of mapping mechanisms, as if the nocturnal spirits were trying to chart my dreams. Our ranch house was located just north of Divide, Montana, a tiny town you can miss from the highway if you happen to adjust your radio at the wrong moment. Surrounded by the Pioneer Mountains, Divide was nestled in a flat-backed valley sprinkled with sagebrush and half-burnt 2x4s, a reminder of when people actually used to live here. The railroad came in from the north, the Big Hole River came in from the west, and both left heading south, searching for brighter pastures. Each had its own way of moving through the land, and each had its own odor of passage. The railway tracks cut straight ahead, asking no questions of the bedrock through which it sliced, the wrought iron rails smelling of axle grease and the wooden slats of rancid, licorice-scented shellac. In contrast, the Big Hole River talked with the land as it wound its way through the valley, collecting creeks as it went, quietly taking the path of least resistance. The Big Hole smelled of moss and mud and sage and occasionally huckleberries, if it was the right time of year, though it had not been the right time of year for many years now. These days, the railway did not stop in Divide, and only Union Pacific freight came rumbling through the valley at 6:42 a.m., 11:53 a.m., and 5:15 p.m., give or take a couple minutes, depending on the weather conditions. The boom era of Montana mining towns was long gone. There was no reason for the train to stop anymore. The Divide, oh, the Divide. I had grown up with this great border at my back, and its quiet, unerring existence had penetrated deep into my bones and brain. The Divide was a massive, sprawling boundary, not delineated by politics, religion, or war, but by tectonics, granite, and gravity. How remarkable that no U.S. president had signed this border into law, and yet its delineation had affected the expansion and formation of America's frontier in a million untold ways. The jagged sentinel sliced the nation's watersheds into east and west, the Atlantic and the Pacific, and out west, water was gold, and where the water went, people followed. The raindrops, blown a mile west of our ranch, would land in creeks that percolated through the Columbia River system into the Pacific, whereas the water in Feely Creek, our creek, was blessed with the task of traveling 1,000 miles more, all the way down to the bayous of Louisiana, before spilling through the Lomi Delta into the Gulf of Mexico. Layton and I used to climb Bald Man's Gap, the exact apex of the Divide, he taking care not to spill the glass of water clutched in between his hands, while I minded a rudimentary pinhole camera that I had fashioned from a shoebox. I would take pictures of him pouring water on either side of the hill, running back and forth, alternately yelling, "Hello, Portland," with "Hello, Nolens," in his best Creole accent. As much as I work the dials on the side of the box, the pictures never quite captured the heroism of Leighton in that moment. Leighton once said at the dinner table after one of our expeditions, "We can learn a lot from a river, can't we, Dad?" And though Father didn't say anything at the time, you could see in the way he ate the rest of his mash that he appreciated that kind of thinking in his son. Father loved Leighton as much as anything in his life. Out on the porch, Gracie shucked, and I mapped. The tickers and clickers spattered the fields of our ranch with their droning orchestration, and August swam all around us, hot, thick, and remarkable. Dr. Clare came out on the back porch. Gracie and I both looked up as we heard the old porch creak under her footsteps. Squeezed tightly between thumb and forefinger, she held a pin, on the end of which gleamed a bright blue metallic beetle that I recognized as Cincidella purpurea lauta, a rare subspecies of the cowpath tiger beetle from Oregon. My mother was a tall, bony woman whose skin was so pasty that people often stared as we passed them on the street in Butte. I once heard an older woman in a flowered sun hat remark, "Such fragile wrists," to her traveling partner. And it was true. If she weren't my mother, I would have thought there was something wrong with her. Dr. Clare pulled her dark hair back into a bun using two polished sticks that looked like bones. She only took her hair down at night, and even then, only behind closed doors. When we were younger, Gracie and I used to take turns peeking through the keyhole at the hidden scene of grooming on the other side. The keyhole was too small to see the whole picture. You could only make out her elbow moving back and forth, as if she were working some old loom. Or, if you moved your body just slightly, you might be lucky enough to see some of the hair itself, the comb returning again and again, making that quiet thrushing sound. The keyhole, the peeking, the threshing, it all seemed so deliciously naughty at the time. Leighton, like Father, wasn't interested in anything that had to do with beauty or hygiene, and thus never joined us. He belonged with Father in the fields, punching cows and breaking broncs. For a moment, she just stood there, surveying Gracie with the big tin buckets of yellow ears between her legs and me on the stairs with my notebook and my magnifying glass headpiece. We looked back at her. And then she said, "Phone for you, T.S. "Phone? For him?" Gracie said, shocked. "Yes, Gracie. The phone's for T.S., Dr. Clare said, not without some satisfaction. "Who's calling?" I asked. "Oh, I'm not sure who it is. I didn't ask," my mother said, still twirling her tiger beetle in the light. Dr. Clare was the kind of mother who would teach you the periodic table while feeding you porridge as an infant, but not the type, in this age of global terrorism and child kidnappers, to ask who might be calling her children on the telephone. My curiosity about the phone call was complicated by the fact that I was in the middle of drawing my map, and an unfinished map always left a little tickle in the back of my throat. On my map, Gracie shucking the sweet corn, number 6, I had put a little numeral 1 next to where she first gripped the husk on the top. Then she yanked downwards 3 times, rip, rip, rip. And this motion I had denoted by 3 arrows, although one arrow was smaller than the others because that first rip was always a little bit belabored. One must overcome the initial inertia of the corn husk. I do love the sound of ripping corn husks. The violence of the noise, the sustained popping and shoring of the silky organic threads made me think of someone tearing up an expensive and potentially Italian set of trousers in a fit of madness that this person might just regret later. At least, that's how Gracie shucked the husks, or husked the shucks, as I sometimes call it. A bit mischievously, I might add, because for some reason it upset my mother when I bent words in this way.
You couldn't blame her, really. She was a beetle scientist, and she had spent nearly all of her adult life studying very small creatures under a magnifying glass, and then precisely classifying them into families and superfamilies, species and subspecies, according to their physical and evolutionary features. We even had a lithograph of Carolus Linnaeus, the Swedish inventor of the modern taxonomic classification system, hanging above the fireplace, much to Father's silent and ongoing protestations. So in a way, it made sense that Dr. Clare would get annoyed at me when I said grasshopper instead of grasshopper, or ex-parrotpus instead of asparagus, because her job was to pay very close attention to the smallest details that the human eye could not possibly see, and then ensure that the presence of a hair on the tip of the mandible or a little white rear maculation on the elytra meant that the beetle was a C. purpurea purpurea and not a C. purpurea lauta. Personally, I thought my mother should be less concerned about my inventive wordplay, which was a kind of mental aerobics that all healthy 12-year-old boys engaged in, but rather pay more attention to the mild insanity that took hold of Gracie when she hussed the shucks, because this really ran against her general character as a bona fide adult trapped in the body of a 16-year-old, and to me pointed to some unaddressed wellspring of anger. I suppose I could safely say that even though Gracie was only 4 years my elder, she was many years beyond me in terms of maturity, common sense, knowledge of social custom, understanding of the dramatic posture. Perhaps the unhinged look she cultivated on her face while shucking the corn was nothing more than that, a cultivation. Just another cue that Gracie was a misunderstood actress sharpening her forte during one of the many mundane chores on a Montana ranch. Perhaps. But I was more partial to the idea that, beneath her pristine exterior, she was actually just unhinged. Oh, Gracie. Dr. Clare said she was absolutely dazzling as the lead in her high school's production of Pirates of Penzance, although I could not attend because I was finishing a behavior map for Science magazine on how the female Australian dung beetle, Ornithophagus sagittarius, used its horns during copulation. I didn't tell Dr. Clare about this project, as she gets mad when I work with other scientists in her field of expertise. I merely complained of a stomachache and then got very well to eat some sage and threw up all over the porch and then pretended it was mine, pretended I had eaten the sage and the mouse bones and the dog food. Gracie was probably miraculous as the pirate's wife. She was a miraculous woman in general, and probably the most together member of our family. For when you got right down to it, Dr. Clare was a misguided coleopterist who, for 20 years, had been chasing a phantom species of beetle, the tiger monk, Cincidella nosferati, that even she was not sure truly existed. And my father, Tecumseh Elijah Spivitt, was a quiet and brooding bronc buster who would walk into a room and say something like, "You can't bullshit a cricket," and then just leave. The type of man who was born perhaps 100 years too late. And then there was my younger brother, Leighton Housling Spivitt, the only Spivitt boy born without the birth name Tecumseh in 5 generations. But Leighton died this past February during an accident with a gun in the barn that no one ever talked about. I was there too, measuring the gunshots. I don't know what went wrong. After that, I hid his name in the topography of every one of my maps. Thank you very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we've been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp for your chance to win a $200 Tattered Cover gift certificate and learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.